Iranian proxy groups, but Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Trump withdrew several hundreds of U.S. troops from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there despite his pledge to end American military presence in the region. How will Biden deal with the situation now? Observers believe by ordering the recent aerial bombardment on the Iraqi-Syrian border, he definitely had a bad start. If Biden stays on the same dangerous course, he risks further destabilizing Iraq and broader clashes with resistance groups.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, adverse effects of sins. Adverse effects of sins are many, and we know that, right? But we are trying to mention a few of them so it becomes, inshallah, a deterrent factor for our listeners to refraining from committing any sins. Well, things become difficult for you if you're a sinner. God tells us in the Holy Quran, and whoever fears Allah, He will make for him of his matter ease. So obviously the one who disobeys Allah will not find his affairs facilitated. You know, his means may become tightened and would find doors closed, you know, opportunities closed on him, right? If you want to open up those opportunities and make things easier for you, then you know the tip for acquiring and accomplishing that, and that is not to sin. Otherwise, things will become difficult for you. Another adverse effect of sin is that your prayers aren't accepted. Well, sins hinder the acceptance of dua. You know, a dua of a mu'min, a supplication, a prayer of a mu'min, a believer, is a weapon, right? According to a tradition, every dua of mu'min is accepted, but in many cases, duas of a sinner don't even reach Allah, let alone be accepted. So, question for you, and this is where especially our youth have to ponder. Do you want Allah to listen to your supplications, to your duas, to your wishes? Well, if yes, then you cannot be sinning at all. Being a believer in the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, being a believer in Quran, you don't have a choice to commit any sin. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the adverse effects of sins. We have mentioned two of them in today's program, and we're going to do two more, so it gives you, inshallah, strength to fight your whims and wishes and not commit any sin, inshallah, and likewise for myself. Well, one of the adverse effects of sins is that it weakens the heart, body, and soul. Right, one of the evils of sins is that it weakens a person's heart. A person finds it hard to show mercy and compassion from the heart. persistent sinning leads to weakness in the body and limbs. They find it hard to bow down and pray, nor fast for the sake of Allah. When this becomes perpetual, then it affects the soul if one dies in that state. Last but not the least, we're going to talk about another adverse effect of sinning, and that is that sins open doors for more sins, right? So it becomes a cycle. Sinfulness is like a chain reaction where one sin leads to another. The more you continue sinning without repentance, the better you get established as a sinner. A good example is telling lies. You can hardly tell a lie without bringing up another false tale to cover up. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, "Beware of lying, as lying leads to transgression, and transgression leads to the fire." Okay, this is where he's referring to the hellfire. So brothers and sisters, we know that sinning is bad. We just need to be convinced enough to be able to stop ourselves from sinning. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It is despicable and unacceptable that there is not unanimous support among Democrats in Congress for a $15 minimum wage, said Representative Jamal Bauman. The listeners stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stansil, author. This article is published under the heading Shameful. Millionaire senators vote against popular minimum wage raise that would lift millions out of poverty. Here's more on that. After 8 members of the Democratic caucus joined all 50 Republicans in the U.S. Senate recently to kill an amendment reattaching a $15 minimum wage provision to the Senate's coronavirus relief package, Progressive pointed out that nearly every single one of the lawmakers who voted against the raise for low-paid workers nationwide is a millionaire. Today's vote on Senator Sanders' $15 minimum wage amendment is incredibly sad. Morris Pirrell, chair of the Patriotic Millionaires and author of the forthcoming book, Tax the Rich, said in a statement recently. The $15 per hour is the bare minimum anyone in this country needs to survive, Pirrell continued. And it is baffling that any member of the U.S. Senate, much less a number of Democrats, could look at the crisis this country is enduring and decide that tens of millions of low-income workers, including millions of frontline workers who put their lives on the line every day in the midst of a global pandemic, should not get a raise, he added. Nina Turner, co-chair of Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign and current candidate running for election to U.S. House in Ohio's 11th district, responded to the vote by tweeting, "Every single one of the senators who voted against raising the minimum wage is a millionaire." Journalist Ken Klippestein shared the net worth according to the most recent financial disclosures compiled by the Center for Responsive Politics of the 8 Democrats who voted against Sanders' $15 minimum wage amendment. While her present net worth may trail that of other lawmakers, Senator Kyrsten Sinema was especially enthusiastic about denying a raise to millions of poorly paid U.S. workers. With her $174,000 annual salary, Sinema is well on her way to joining her wealthier colleagues in the millionaire ranks. In his statement, Pirrell said that the Senate failed the American people today. Every single Republican senator who voted against $15 today failed their constituents. Pirrell added, the Democrats who voted against $15 today not only failed their constituents, the decision they made to put some ancient Senate tradition ahead of the priorities that they ran on and that they stand for was wrong economically, morally, and politically, he said. Pirrell was referring to the fact that Senate Democrats removed the $15 minimum wage provision from their version of the COVID-19 relief bill after the White House made clear that Vice President Kamala Harris would not be willing to exercise her authority to override the widely condemned advisory opinion of the Senate parliamentarian, an unelected official with zero constitutional authority, that deemed the proposed pay hike a violation of budget reconciliation rules. Sanders' attempt to use the amendment process to add a federal minimum wage increase to the coronavirus relief legislation came in the wake of that decision. It is despicable and unacceptable, said Representative Jamal Bowman, and he added that there is not unanimous support among Democrats in Congress for a $15 minimum wage. There is no excuse, Pirrell said. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Senator John Tester, Senator Joe Manchin, Senator Chris Kunz, Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Senator Tom Carper, and Maggie Hassan, both failed their people and their party. Neither those voting next year nor those reading the history of the next generation will appreciate those senators who could have changed the course of history, but chose not to. Undeterred, Sanders said recently that if any senator believes this is the last time they will cast a vote on whether or not to give a raise to 32 million Americans, they're sorely mistaken. We're going to keep bringing it up, and we're going to get it done because it is what the Americans demand and need. Joining the Sanders was Representative Pramila Jayapal, who tweeted that she will never stop fighting to make the minimum wage a living wage. It's long overdue that we give 32 million workers a raise and lift a million people out of poverty, Jayapal added.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam my deen. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, other life forms. May peace and salutations be upon you. Anyway, I'm Zainab. This is Youth Station. Today we're going to be talking about...
I'm here too.
Sorry.
I'm Muzaffar Haider. The twin. Apple pie. I like chicken mushroom pie.
Oh, yes. I wouldn't say I just like pie. Have you ever had tuna pie?
No.
It's weirdly delicious.
That sounds good, actually. Yeah, no, that would be nice. Yeah, I haven't had it, though.
Something really buttery, oniony, tuna-y. Anyway.
Oh, yes. That is what we need. Quiche.
Chicken quiche?
Quiche.
I've never had quiche.
You never had quiche?
No.
I made quiche recently. I actually made it.
You cook?
It was... Yeah, I cook really good. I cook... Nobody believes this, yeah? But I cook damn good.
Really?
Yeah. Spaghetti bolognese, I make pasta, lasagna, and I make pizza, and I make
Teach me your ways. I don't even cook. I never do the cooking at home. He does.
Butter chicken, dopiaza. You know, dopiaza is an Iranian dish? I didn't even know that. But there's an Indian version.
My mouth is watering, and I'm pretty sure you guys' mouth is watering too. And the reason why we're doing this to ourselves is because today's topic of conversation is food in the Quran.
Dramatic.
Very. Yeah. Did you know that there are over 250 verses in the Holy Quran regarding food?
No.
Now you do.
Way.
Yeah.
Food is important. Without food, do you know what happens? I mean, I've done some research into it.
Tell me.
Without food, people die.
No.
Yes. They just stop living. Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah, no. It's not just something that tastes good. It actually keeps us alive. There are actually people in the world who die because they don't.
The human body can go, I think, roughly around 4 months without food? I don't know. Anyway,
I just
made that up.
No.
But back to the fact that there are over 250 verses in the Quran and a kajillion ahadith from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam regarding food.
Mm.
What's the first verse that comes to your mind regarding food in the Quran?
This is actually the first verse that came to my mind, but what? I don't have it memorized. It's when Bani Israel, they come to Musa.
Oh, yeah.
He sent down manna and salwa from the sky, right? This is like heavenly divine food for these people. But they get sick of it. And they say, "What?" And the Quran says, وَإِذْ قُلْتُمْ يَا مُوسَى. They said, "Oh Musa, لَنَّصْبِرْ عَلَىٰ طَعَامٍ وَاحِدٍ. We can't be patient on one food." And so they say, "Call upon your Lord to bring forth for us from the earth its green herbs and its cucumbers and its garlic and its lentils and its onions." Yeah, that makes your mouth water, right? I mean, okay, look, they're really picky and everything, but this point, I can imagine myself. I have a fat person's personality. I can imagine myself doing that, you know.
You're a foodie?
In front of my mom is a man. Yeah, your mom is a man. You know, we've been fighting on the battlefield. And so, is it too much to ask for some, you know, lentils? Some garlic?
But the thing, well, you've never tasted mennoa selwa.
Well, apparently it was really dry and plain, I guess. But it was divine, so they should have appreciated it. But they were like, oh, we were expecting something better. Maybe it was beautiful, but the point is, human beings, they just can't tolerate one type of food over
and
over.
But we do it for
again.
Breakfast. Isn't that weird? We have all the same breakfast almost every day.
That's interesting, yeah. But imagine if you were having that same thing for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
I've been known to do it. Anyway.
Yeah, that's true. I can have spaghetti bolognese for breakfast, lunch. No, but the first point that I wanted to kind of allude to through this verse is don't live to eat.
Definitely.
Eat to live.
Wow.
Right?
Wiser words have never been spoken.
Thank you. But that's what the thing is. Some people, they live so that they can eat. And you can apply this elsewhere as well. Wait,
so that
what?
They can eat. It's their life objective. All they think about is what's their next meal going
to
be.
Yeah, yeah. Or they live to work, or they live to earn money, or they live to do lots of different things and to entertain themselves. There's other people who eat to live. I don't know why I'm elaborating on it. I mean, it's very clear. It's self-explanatory, but I mean, I kind of just ruined it, didn't I? But yeah.
No, it's fine. Mm. Another verse that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about food in the Quran, and it really... You know how you were going on and on in the beginning of the show, how if we don't eat, we'll die,
mm-hmm.
right? And Allah basically acknowledges that and counts it as a huge blessing that we should be grateful toward Allah for. أَلَّذِي أَطْمَعَهُمْ مِنْ جُوعٍ وَأَمَنَهُمْ مِنْ خَوْفٍ Right?
Mm.
In Surah...
Quraysh.
Yes, sir. And Allah says, فَلْيَعْبُدُوا رَبَّ هَذَا الْبَيْتِ Worship the Lord of this house, the house of Kaaba, because he is the one who feeds you when you're hungry.
Mm.
Do you see the correlation here?
Yeah.
Number one, it is the job, it is the duty of the God who created to provide for the needs and cater to the requirements of his creation.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's food, whether it's other material needs.
Wallahu khayrul raziqin.
Exactly. Mm. He's the best provider. So this just, if we expand on that, it could bring different things into light for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we will understand that there is nothing we desire within us. A desire that is in accordance with our fitrah, with our nature, right? Because sometimes I could say that...
With the divine innate nature.
Exactly.
The divine nature, yeah.
I desire a Lamborghini. Even that, I do believe, that is in accordance with my fitrah because I seek perfection. Right? I seek mm-hmm. the best. I mm-hmm. seek beauty. And as my Lord and my Creator, it is His duty, it is upon Him to cater to my needs that will result in a prosperous life in this world and the next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely.
So
I was
it's
just,
not just
actually,
limited
just
to
thinking about this.
Where you know.
Desires that Allah, yes. There are desires that Allah has put into our hearts. Like, for example, the most basic of these is like to live forever, even though we won't really admit it. But just naturally, it is there that you don't want to stop living right now, this very instant,
I
right?
I don't mind it.
Yeah. You might say to yourself, I would rather die than live to the age of 100, right? And that makes sense because you don't want to be old because being old sucks. This is Youth Station, by the way. So if there's any old people who are listening and going to get offended and send us emails. But, you know, generally speaking, yeah, this feeling of wanting to live forever or being eternal. You don't want to be eternal?
No.
You don't want to live forever in heaven?
25 years was more than enough.
In
can't
heaven?
I handle this. But there's no guarantee I'd go to heaven. Is
what?
There?
One of the scariest things my mom told me when I was little is, look, you're going to go to heaven, inshallah, if you be good. But then eventually you're just going to end. Because we didn't know much about Islam back in those days, right?
Oh,
so
right.
We didn't understand the idea of being eternal in heaven and stuff. And that just made me really sad. I was like, what's the point then if I'm just going to end? after like a thousand years. I don't want to do that. I don't want to end.
What do you say? Our desire is to live forever.
Allah puts these desires in our heart. They must be there for a reason.
Yes. Yeah. And we have to look for...
as silly as they might seem, like you gave the example of Lamborghini and stuff, you know. Even the Quran talks about, you know, not cars, but horses of, you know,
even he counts that. He considers that as a ni'mah, as a blessing. Vehicles.
Yeah.
Vessels that, you know, transportation, basically, in the Quran, along with food.
Yeah. Another verse which comes to mind now is about the food which is lawful and unlawful.
Mm.
Right. And there's a couple of verses in this regard, you know, regarding the Jews and how certain foods were halal for them before it became haram for them later. And also we see it in the verse which, you know, the verse about Eid al-Ghadir, the one that we often recite, Al-Yawma Akmaltu Lakum Dinakum. Right, that verse, if you look at it in more detail, you know, it says, you know, you should refrain from eating carcass. We've made these things haram for you, carcass and the flesh of swine and other things which are haram. So there's this whole discussion in Islam about what foods are halal and which foods are haram.
Definitely.
Yeah. So it is,
what do you think the philosophy behind that is?
Allah has made halal for us that which benefits us.
Why create it if it's not going to benefit me?
Because they have benefits for other purposes, but not necessarily for us consuming them, right? And it might be that it harms your mind, your body, or your soul. There are certain substances which, if you eat them, they will harm your mind, right? They'll give you trips and hallucinations and stuff.
Like shrooms.
That's the thing I was thinking of, mushrooms, right? Magic mushrooms, which is probably haram because it's, you know, you have to check with your marja. But the point is, it's affected your mind in a negative way in the long term. And then there's other foods which physically obviously harm you. They make you fat. They make you, I don't know, they're
obese, diabetes, cholesterol.
Give you worms and stuff, nasty things, right? And the other part which is severely neglected is your soul. Your soul will be affected.
Like what?
Negatively. And remember, all three of these things go hand in hand. So there are certain chemicals which are put into the body which will affect your soul, right? Foods. Like, okay, for example, swine. I've heard that eating swine causes shamelessness. Yeah, shamelessness. It's one of those things which isn't often discussed, but yeah, I found that really interesting. It stood out to me, and it would explain a lot.
A lot.
Yeah. It would explain a lot, right?
You know, something else that this whole Islam's dietary rulings has made me realize is that people constantly, especially like 21st century people, millennials, vegans, and whatnot, this group of people, that ilk, are constantly about saving nature and being kind to animals and how can we find it in us to slaughter these beautiful things. What's the difference between a puppy and a sheep?
We don't eat no puppies.
Exactly. And they're saying that even Islam is cruel to allow that method of slaughtering and this and that, and it's just trying to justify it by saying that it's the most humane method. But when you look at Islam's dietary standards and the rulings regarding things we are not allowed to eat, Islam really limits the things that we can eat. And as a matter of fact, we're being the humane ones. It's y'all who go around and eat everything that walks and crawls and flies on land, in sea, and in the air, right? Without any restrictions whatsoever, to a point of exhausting nature's resources.
Yeah.
But if you look at it from an Islamic perspective, there's only a limited species of animals we're allowed to consume. There's cows, there's sheep, there's goat. Donkey and horse is makruh. We're not allowed to have pork.
Humans, haram. Human flesh.
I'm pretty sure it's also illegal.
Cannibalism is...
very illegal.
Nasty.
And even rules regarding hunting, right? You're not allowed to hunt for fun. You're not allowed to hunt on a bet. You're not allowed to hunt for pleasure. It should only be for the purpose of providing for your family's necessary needs.
Yeah, and also let's address this point, because the mentality that you know we shouldn't eat meat because it's harmful or because it causes pain doesn't make sense. Because what are you going to do? Just eat vegetables? Why? Because they don't feel pain, but some plants do feel pain.
And even regarding that, there's those demons of yours. There's a hadith from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam that don't turn your stomach into the sanctuary of the graveyard of animals, the cemetery of animals. Yeah. Right? Yeah. It means that Islam. And then there's another hadith that says a believer should not eat meat for more than 40 days, because then he's going to become grumpy. Iron deficiency.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. Grumpy, so right. Balance.
Yes, and also if we look at this from a purely scientific point of view, animals which are herbivores usually only have molar-type teeth.
Yeah.
And animals which are carnivores have incisors, you know, the sharp, pointy type
canine.
Of teeth. Humans have both, canines, right?
We only have two sharp teeth and it barely cuts through raw meat. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. Thank you so very much, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us. Until another segment of the show, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong. Because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, I will when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was spot on when he said at the United Nations Human Rights Council meeting on 24th of February, the pandemic has exacerbated old problems such as racism and xenophobia, as well as discrimination against national and religious minorities. Mass protests in the United States and Europe have exposed these countries' continuing systemic inequalities, whilst highlighting the risks of condoning extremist ideologies. We're prepared for you an article written by former Indian diplomat M.K. Badrakumar under the heading, U.S. Exceptionalism Surges Again, Will It Fly? The article has been taken from the AsiaTimes.com website. Please stay with us for more of M.K. Badrakumar's article. In recent statement marking the return of the United States to the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, claimed that President Joe Biden's administration is placing democracy and human rights at the center of American foreign policy. But the cat is out of the bag. The U.S. is in relative decline and there is a resource crunch. There is an absence of a positive vision for humanity as the country struggles with its own demons. the dramatic events in American society and politics in recent past badly exposed the country as a sham democracy with an abominable record of racism and appalling inequality, where the top 0.1% of the population hold roughly the same share of the country's wealth as the bottom 90% of the population. But the resurrection of American exceptionalism will have no takers, and the United States, lacking the capacity and the moral authority to advance a unifying agenda in the international arena, is assembling a toolkit for its diplomacy with geopolitical objectives. The potential of the United Nations Human Rights Council ought to be directed at the raging COVID-19 pandemic, which has undermined the social and economic foundations of states. The most fundamental human right, the right to life, has been threatened, with the world economic downturn causing a big rise in unemployment and aggravating social insecurity. The development gaps between nations and regions are widening. Yet the United States is in a category of itself, even among the so-called rich countries of the world. COVID-19 deaths per million inhabitants have gone through the roof in the United States in comparison with its own allies. The appalling reality is that in the United States, the death toll from the epidemic has now gone over 500,000. Ironically, per capita COVID-19 deaths in some of the countries that Anthony Blinken berates for deficit in democracy and human rights put the U.S. to shame, including in Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and Sri Lanka, and of course, China. But for the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, such a horrific level of deaths among his countrymen isn't a human rights issue. Not a single state functionary in the United States has been held responsible for such a tragedy of unspeakable proportions. Suffice it to say, the U.S. is bringing disrepute and shame to the whole Western world by leading them into such a cynical game. Strutting around as champions of human rights when, according to a recent estimate, more than half of all vaccines against COVID-19 have been reserved for 1/7 of the world's population. Isn't that a matter of human rights? The United Kingdom alone has reportedly secured enough vaccines to give each of its citizens 5 doses. If orders are met, the European Union and the United States could inoculate their populations 3 times over, whilst Canada would have enough to do so 9 times over. It is a disaster, Mr. Blinken. At the same time, competition for diminishing vaccine supplies may lead to price hikes and further friction. Acrimony has erupted among the European Union, the United Kingdom, and AstraZeneca over a shortfall in vaccine production. Meanwhile, in any situation where supplies are scarce and demand is rising, it is the poorer countries that will suffer most. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was spot on when he said at the United Nations Human Rights Council meeting on 24th of February, "The pandemic has exacerbated old problems such as racism and xenophobia, as well as discrimination against national and religious minorities. Mass protests in the United States and in Europe have exposed these countries' continuing systemic inequalities, whilst highlighting the risks of condoning extremist ideologies. It is utter moral bankruptcy that the United States and its rich allies in the Western world walk into the United Nations Human Rights Council and start pontificating about human rights and pursue coercive approaches and unlawful methods of intimidation and pressure with narrow and self-serving geopolitical goals. Again, aren't the non-transparent policies of social networking platforms a matter of human rights too? The US, in particular, undertook commitments to ensure freedom of access to information for all citizens, but is now hiding behind corporate policies to avoid delivering on these commitments. As for the social networking platforms, they have begun brazenly to manipulate public opinion in the developing countries, by banning or censoring user content at their own discretion. Now they are, under United States protection, trampling on the human rights of world citizens, aren't they? The Human Rights Toolkit is universally applicable, and there are many countries on Earth, including the United States of America, that have a problem with democracy and human rights. Isn't it a crying shame that an average black American lives 6 years less than his white countrymen? Don't black Americans get locked up in jails in much larger numbers than whites? But the United States' human rights standards are highly selective. It's the white man's burden. Evidently, the toolkit becomes a potent weapon to stigmatize the United States' rivals, Russia and China, and to pressure small countries that do not conform to America's wrong policies, countries like Sri Lanka, Cuba, and Venezuela. The toolkit has been used to bring about regime change too, that is, overthrow established governments and replace them with client regimes. The best-known examples are Ukraine and Georgia. A recent attempt has been made in Belarus, but that flopped. A trial project in Russia in recent weeks was simply squashed by the Kremlin. But it is a developing story. The countries in the periphery of Russia are being systematically destabilized and turned into theaters of geopolitical contestation so that the United States' great rival will get entrapped in a quagmire. The Biden administration is using this toolkit to try to establish the United States' so-called transatlantic leadership, which Europe is no longer comfortable with. Europe is experiencing the hidden charms of strategic autonomy. But the US cannot hope to exercise global hegemony without the Western alliance system backing it either. In the shadow play, Joe Biden estimates that the human rights plank stands the best chance of bringing the United States' Western allies on board under its leadership. Indeed, the Western concept of human rights, narrowly focused on freedom of speech and freedom of religion and democratic elections, tends to overlook that the basic right of the bulk of humanity is about the right to life and the right to development. The Western countries refuse to accept the fact that there are many roads to development and prosperity for the developing countries, and their path is only one of them, and perhaps not even the best or the most suitable path. Plainly put, human rights are being used as a tool to reinforce and perpetuate the present global order in accordance with Western interests. However, it is a losing battle. A new world order is taking shape with a vastly different global humanitarian agenda, which will inevitably become the mainstream for human society. According to a plan jointly issued recently by the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China and the State Council on China's Comprehensive Transportation Network layout, the country aims to build all over the world 200,000 kilometers of railways, 460,000 kilometers of highways, and 25,000 kilometers of high-level sea lanes, with 27 major coastal ports, 400 civil transportation airports, and 80 express hubs by 2035. Which will make the country not only a global production center, but a logistics center, trade center, clearing center, and financial center, laying a solid foundation for a path to be the world's economic center, as an expert put it. How could the Biden administration possibly counter this latest Chinese challenge? Unsurprisingly, the United States is at its wit's end in dealing with China's surge. In 2020, China's gross domestic product was more than 70% the size of the United States. The current forecast is that it will surpass the United States to be the world's largest economy by 2028. The U.S. realizes that the economic race is pretty much already lost.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The qualities of the people of Azerbaijan that helped create the 29th of Behman event. Another characteristic is the important role played by outstanding personalities. There are many personalities in this area who played a leading role in all the matters of the country. They are unforgettable personalities. I will tell you that we should not let this glorious history be consigned to oblivion. This history should be preserved. Undoubtedly, without a correct analysis of the history of Azerbaijan, every analysis of the history of Iran is incomplete and defective. Those who are experts and who are enthusiastic should embark on presenting a correct analysis of the issues of Azerbaijan. These were a few short points about Azerbaijan and Tabriz.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
As for the 29th of Behman of 1356, after that event, Imam issued a message in which he cited three characteristics of the dear people of Tabriz. The word dear also existed in the message issued by Imam, the dear people of Azerbaijan. He mentioned three characteristics: courage, zeal, and piety. Our magnanimous Imam mentioned these three characteristics in his message to Azerbaijan. All three characteristics are really important criteria for evaluating a group of people and assessing their activities and endeavors. Courage, zeal, and piety, in the right place and right time. When the people of Tabriz staged an uprising, in my opinion, this is an important point which should receive attention. They had already seen the 19th of Day event in Qom. They have already seen how savagely the regime entered the arena to kill the people. And the regime thought that it had managed to take away the people's courage from them after the Qom incident, and that no one would dare to enter the arena.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
Around the World with Reporters.
Hundreds of medical workers have gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a. They denounced the international community for turning a blind eye on the continued seizure of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has put the war-torn country to a severe fuel crisis.
I suffer from kidney failure and I have to travel 50 kilometers to get to the dialysis center despite the lack of fuel. I need dialysis 3 times a week, but I only get one because of the blockade on our country. We call on the international organizations to stand by our side and help us to get the fuel in order to save our lives.
The Ministry of Health said over 1,500 medical facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown due to the lack of fuel. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the seized oil tankers.
Blocking oil vessels from entering the country threatens to stop many health facilities. There are more than 1,500 health centers and 400 laboratories and blood banks on the verge of closure. Centers that generate oxygen may also stop. The lives of patients may end within days. Patients with kidney problems are the most affected. There are more than 5,000 patients who need dialysis several times a week.
The United Nations says the Saudi war on Yemen, along with the years-long blockade, has driven the country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Thousands of patients, including children, may lose their lives within days unless the international community breaks its silence and pressures Saudi Arabia to release the illegally detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
About turning innovative ideas into practice. Towards Stars is the title of this exhibition, which puts on display the latest technologies that are made in Iran. A whole range of high-tech products, from mapping drones to smart medical equipment, are showcased here. Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, hailed the Iranian tech companies for helping to keep the national industries afloat amid foreign pressures.
In spite of the unilateral sanctions on our country, we have been able to serve our needs by tapping into our domestic resources and young minds. Technological development builds power and makes us independent from foreign powers. When a nation is independent, no other country can exert pressure on it.
The event was inspired by remarks made by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in August last year, where he put emphasis on the need to focus on science-based production and avoid exporting raw material and bulk goods, such as saffron. Given the fact that Iran produces 90% of the world's saffron, this Iranian producer has launched the so-called OSEC. It might sound music to the ears, since it rhymes with OPEC. Only the letter S stands for saffron. The Organization of Saffron Exporting Countries now is an established entity comprising 10 member states, with the goal to organize the global market.
The idea to set up the OSEC was driven by the fact that Iran, which has OSEC, is the hub of saffron production. But when it comes to exports, we are lagging behind. So OSEC seeks to organize the global market, not only for saffron, but with regards to caraway and caviar.
Well, there's a growing focus in Iran on commercializing indigenous products. This medical firm says the issue of marketing is still an alien word when it comes to Iranian-made products. But it says that's what it does.
Our company offers medical services in Iraq, Indonesia, and Afghanistan using Iranian-made equipment like hemodialysis systems and central water purification systems. In fact, we do the marketing job for Iranian manufacturers of medical equipment and offer the related services for our clients. We are working to find clients in more countries.
Iran has recently been trying to make a shift from an oil-based economy to other sources of income. The major drive behind such a move is to shield the economy from the ups and downs of oil prices. In recent years, such a shift is more vital, since Iran's crude sales have slashed as a result of U.S.'s unilateral sanctions against Iran. This event comes as Iran is already rewiring its economy based on domestic production. This is significant given the fact that U.S. sanctions against Iran have denied the country access to foreign trade. But Iran regards the restrictions as a blessing in disguise, saying self-sufficiency is the fruit of sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held in the Israeli military jail of Aofir declared a set of measures, including a partial hunger strike, to protest excessive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service that have been escalating dramatically. According to Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, prisoners in Aofir jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, intensive provocative cell searches, and repeated raids on prisoners' rooms, especially at night. Prisoners have also been suffering from transfers from one prison to another, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
Israeli measures are illegal and they are carried out against the prisoners in Aofir every day. That's why we say what goes on in Israeli jails amounts to a crime against the prisoners. Today the prisoners are suffering from medical negligence. We hold Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of these actions.
Talks have been held between prisoners and the Israel prison service. However, they have failed to meet the inmates' key demands. Thus, the prisoners will even escalate their protest measures within the coming days. Palestinian prisoners have been trying to resist the crackdown through all possible means, including by cutting military cords and going on hunger strikes.
Hunger strikes are almost the only means which the inmates have at hand to put pressure on Israeli authorities. Israel knows very well that the prisoners are able to achieve victory through their hunger strike and protest action as they did in the past.
Human rights organizations say Israel continues to violate all rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention and international laws. Today, over 4,500 Palestinians are languishing in a number of Israeli jails, according to Palestinian reports. Palestinian inmates have been subjected to systematic torture all through the years of Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Those prisoners are behind bars in the first place for defying the Israeli occupation in all its forms. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
It's been almost 6 months since the first intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, but so far, no viable agreement has been reached. The situation in Afghanistan has now become so complicated that the Afghan president is agreeing to hold an early